Shalom and welcome to Nourish Your Biblical Roots Conversations with Yael. I'm your host, Yael Eckstein, President and CEO of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. My work with the fellowship gives me the unique opportunity to spend time with luminaries, both from the Christian and Jewish world, in both the U.S. and Israel. And on my podcast, I want to share some of those brilliant thought leaders with you. Today's guest has spent most of his life as a Jewish leader in the U.S., and then in 2016, he was appointed as U.S. ambassador to Israel under President Trump. Before that, he served in the position of having a very successful legal career. He saw huge accomplishments as the U.S. ambassador to Israel between 2016 and 2020. We are all familiar with the historic Abraham Accords. These are the historic and prophetic agreements between Israel and some of the Arab countries, which has brought peace between Israel and many of the neighbors who were once enemies. For this important work, Ambassador Friedman was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. In his upcoming book, the second book in just 2 years, which is going to be released on September 3rd, Ambassador Friedman has a foreword by former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The book is called One Jewish State, and it outlines brilliantly his vision of how to bring peace to Israel, the entire Middle East, and ultimately the world. The ambassador very generously took time from his very busy schedule to come and talk to us. I am beyond honored to welcome Ambassador David Friedman. Welcome to my podcast.
Thank you, Al. It's really great to be with you. And thank you for everything you do. Your work is really inspiring and so important.
Thank you so much, Ambassador. We have so much to discuss, but I'm going to start at the beginning. Many people don't know this, but your father was a rabbi. Can you tell me a little bit about early childhood being raised by a rabbi as a father and how it shaped who you are today?
So I was the youngest of three children. My older siblings, I think, had problems being, you know, the center of attention. I loved it. I loved being the rabbi's son. I would go to synagogue. I would get some, you know, amount of attention totally beyond what I deserved. And I enjoyed it. And I learned a lot from my father because he was a great rabbi. He used to command a congregation of sometimes over 1,000 people. High holidays, he had over 3,000 people. And the one thing that I think will just give you a sense of what he was like was Yom Kippur 1973, right? The Yom Kippur War.
Yeah.
When word got out about the war and about the challenges Israel was facing. So he spoke to a congregation of 3,000 people who had been fasting all day. And he told the ushers to block the doors at the end of the services, and he says, look, I know you're hungry, I know you want to get out of here, but no one leaves until we raise, you know, whatever, I think at the time it was, you know, $500,000, whatever, you know, he thought was needed. We're going to support Israel right now. And I remember, you know, people were yelling like, can he do this? What right does he have to do this? You know, could be a fire hazard, whatever. But he did it. He had the courage of his convictions, and he taught me everything.
Wow. So it sounds like that experience stood out to you as teaching you how to go beyond what's even acceptable in order to accomplish a mission that seemed once impossible.
Yeah. You know, what he really taught me was that if you have the courage of your convictions and you are willing to stand for things, you're going to succeed because most people are willing to be led, are willing to be convinced, people of good faith, but someone's got to get up there in front and say, this is what matters, these are the values we have, and this is the direction I want to go. And look, you'll always get blowback. If you're not getting blowback, you're not doing anything. He had on his desk a bunch of fake turtles. And we've separated them now among all the members of the family, so everybody's got one. But when people used to ask him, what's with the turtles, he said, turtle can only move forward by sticking its neck out. And he said, that's what we got to do. We got to take risks. We got to move forward with risks and, you know, live with the consequences, but own the issues and move forward. And I miss him greatly. You know, the greatest disappointment of my life was that he wasn't alive to see me transition from a lawyer to the ambassador to Israel, which he would have taken great pleasure in.
Well, it sounds like you embody all those values he lived for.
I try.
Because as you describe him, it could be said exactly the same about you. As you're talking, I'm thinking about how you were such a big part of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem after so long of it sitting on the desk of the U.S. presidents. You stuck your neck out. You were that turtle who moved forward and said, if I don't stand for something, I stand for nothing. And took those risks to be marked in history forever, which we're going to get to soon. Mm-hmm. But like you're describing, your father was no ordinary rabbi. He had a sitting president come and visit the synagogue. From what I understand, it was 1984. Roosevelt, was it? And it was
Reagan.
I'm sorry. wrong year. It was the first sitting president since Washington. That's a wild concept. Why did he choose your father? What was that like? What did it represent for America and for you?
Well, you know, it was about a week before the 1984 presidential election. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that he was chosen because it worked within the political calculations of the president's team, which, by the way, it was the last time in American history that New York was carried by a Republican.
Oh, wow.
So they knew what they were doing, apparently. But anyway, they chose him because he was a prominent rabbi.
Yeah.
It was a great visual. My father, I wish I had his height. He was about, 6'2", white hair, white beard, very distinguished, had a little bit of a Moses kind of look.
Yeah.
And I think, the way people tend to make these calculations for presidential politics, it was the right rabbi to be seen with. And, up until the time when I got a chance to hang out in the Oval Office with Trump, that was the closest we got to a president in 1984. My whole family, we had lunch with him, and it was incredible.
Do you think that maybe awakened something inside of you that connected religion with politics, being a light into the nations, with being able to create policy? Did that have a lasting effect that you see a direct line between that meeting in 1984 in the synagogue and sitting in the Oval Office?
Well, it moved me tremendously just because of the ability of one individual, right? One guy who's just like everybody else ultimately has the same, human frailties and qualities, identical biology to everybody else. And he's up there and he's able to make things happen that other people can't. So, of course, it moved. He said something that day that I thought was, in those days, Israel was fighting the UN as it continues to do. But then there was this resolution that Zionism was racism. And I think it had just gotten undone, and people were very cognizant of the challenges that Israel had at the UN. Israel at the UN was not a problem in the early years, like in the 40s and 50s.
When we were weak, they were okay with
us. As long as we're weak, if we're weak, if we're dying, if we're poor, if we're impoverished, then they love us. But once we started getting stronger, that was unacceptable to the world. But he said something that got a huge round of applause, which kind of gave me some chills at the time, which was, he says, if Israel is ever asked to leave the United Nations, the United States and Israel will walk out together.
Mm.
And I thought that was a great line. And I thought that was as good a statement of America's bond with Israel as I had heard. And I realized then that, as much as Israel is a product of God's will, it's the embodiment of biblical prophecy, but it does need friends. It's great to have friends, and to have the United States as your friend, the most powerful nation in the world, the leading nation in the world. When America gets up and says that, it just changes sort of like what you do when you're able to galvanize, tens of millions of Christians to support Israel. It's the same feeling, the sense that we're not alone.
Yeah.
And it moved me tremendously.
It's incredible. I've chills just hearing about it. And I guess what I think about when I hear you talk like that is that you realize from a young age this intrinsic bond between America and Israel, and between politics and the safety of Israel. And very often people understand the purpose that America serves to Israel and Israel's security. As the U.S. ambassador to Israel, I'm assuming you saw the other way as well. The purpose that Israel serves to America and what Israel contributes to American safety as well. Can you talk a little bit on that?
Sure. Well, there's the real politic kind of relationship, which is Israel keeps America safe. America keeps Israel safe. This is a partnership that greatly advantages both countries. I can tell you, without going into details, there's no question that there are Americans alive today on their soil who, God forbid, would not have been alive or might have been terribly injured mm-hmm. were it not for Israel's ability to identify threats from this part of the world in advance of America. But there's a bigger point. The bigger point is if you understand the roots of America, you understand that America was founded on values and principles that are very much deeply embedded in the Bible and its prophecies.
Yeah.
You know, so when America was created, I mean, first of all, you know, these were all biblical scholars who wrote our founding documents. Even before that, you know, I remember John Winthrop, who was the great pilgrim leader, when he had his ship about to enter, you know, Boston Harbor, he prayed for the help that the God of Israel should help those pilgrims. So this was a sense, they thought at that point, there was a sense that God had abandoned the original Jewish people, the Jews of Israel, and they were creating the new Jerusalem. And that was their view. It was deeply rooted in ideas of biblical prophecy. And where it really kind of came out is in the Declaration of Independence, which is, you know, the great founding document of America. What was special about it, right? It said that, you know, our rights, our human rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they don't come from the sovereign, they don't come from the president, they're endowed by our creator, right? And that was a bombshell of national self-governments, because if they're endowed by your creator,
right,
they can't be taken away except by the creator, right? And what were those rights? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, I can take you, and you won't need any help finding them. But you can go through the Bible and see those are the biblical values that God said. God said you should choose life. God said you should be happy. You know, the idea of liberty. You know, the Liberty Bell, right? Which was 50 years in Philadelphia before the Declaration of Independence, right? It says, proclaim liberty throughout the land. Mm-hmm. That's from the book of Leviticus. Yeah. So all of this came, you know, from the Bible. And so, you know, what Israel, you know, and then what happened, of course, was then in 1948, and then in even more so 1967, the Christian world began to realize that, no, God actually didn't abandon the Jewish people. You know, the prophecies are actually going to come true. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, even Moses, all those prophecies are now coming true in the land of Israel. And so that does as much for America as all the, you know, all the intelligence sharing and the technology. Obviously, Israel does all kinds of things that make Americans, you know, more technologically advanced, more secure. But spiritually, I think that's where the real contribution is from Israel to America. It makes people feel like they have meaning in their lives. And when people support Israel in America, they feel that they are helping to advance the actualization of biblical prophecy. You know, what's more important than that, right? So that's, I think that is that's the real contribution that Israel makes.
Incredible. Ambassador, what I hear you saying is that the America First philosophy must be connected to continuing to stand with Israel.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, look. I mean, you know, America First does not mean America alone, right? It's never been what it means, and it is a core American value to stand with Israel, to stand with biblical values. That was what made, you know, you want to talk about what made America great again the first time, right? It was standing with those biblical values. Without those biblical values, we wouldn't have a constitution, we wouldn't have a Declaration of Independence, we wouldn't have the type of architecture of life and self-government that we would have without the Bible. I mean, again, these are all biblical scholars who didn't just read the Bible in English, they read it in the original Hebrew. You look at, you know, the crest of Yale University, right, which was a divinity school when it started, it's got the name of God in Hebrew, in Hebrew letters, right? So, that is who we are. That's who we are as Americans. And at a time now when I think people really are reaching out, like they're desperate for authentic values, what are the values that endure, that have been around forever, that really, you know, we can hang on to because we're so adrift in terms of our values? Those are the values that have lasted. Those are the values that stood the test of time. You know, the Bible, I looked this up a couple of days ago, the Bible sells 2,000 copies an hour.
Woo.
In America alone, 20 million copies a year, right?
Wow.
That means that every year, you know, about 10% of Americans buy their Bible. Yeah. And most of them have had it already. Let's get a new one.
Right.
So it really does matter. And it matters more than ever at a time when we are really searching for what really, you know, matters in life.
It's fascinating because what I hear you saying is the foundation of America when it was founded and all the values that it was built upon are these biblical values in a time also when society didn't necessarily reflect that, but they had the Bible as their guiding star, all men created equal. Well, we know there was slavery and all different kinds of issues then, but they still had this guiding star, this deep faith of what the ideal is and a society that they want to build on that. And in a way, what we're seeing now is the unraveling of that, mm-hmm. of trying to erase those values from a society that got strong based on them. Mm-hmm. And it's a tale as old as time. We've seen the Greeks and the Romans and all the great empires fall when those biblical values started to unravel. And so what I hear you saying is that there is a deep connection between the values of America and the connection to Israel, both in a spiritual and a practical and a security. You said there are Americans who are alive today on American soil because of what Israel has contributed. You were assigned ambassadorship in 2016 under President Trump, U.S. ambassador to Israel, nominated and appointed. And you stood strongly for those values, unapologetically. What type of difficulties did you face in so boldly standing with Israel?
It's a long story, but I'll give you a few. Well, look, the first thing is when I got the job, the president said to me in the first instance, he said, look, you know, there's 193 countries in the world. We have embassies in about 185 of them. You know, I got to appoint the 185 ambassadors. Most of them are going to throw parties, right, and get dressed up and
have fun.
Go to events and have events. Okay, this is not the job. If you want to, you know, put on a tuxedo and go to a ball, you know, I'll put you in Italy. I'll put you in London. You know, but you know, that's not Israel. Israel's a real working job. You up for it? I said, 100%. Wow. So you know, my feeling is, you know, if you're going to take a job like this, and you don't have an agenda, like, why bother? Why bother? This is such a meaningful position. Mm-hmm. If you don't have goals and, you know, if you're just there to, you know, fill up space, it's not worth the effort because it's a hard job. I really looked at it from the beginning that, you know, I had very specific things I wanted to accomplish. I mean, and I said, I'm going to do all these, as long as, you know, I have the support of the president, I'll be able to get them done. If I have the support of the president, I'm going to keep going. If I don't, then, you know, we'll let somebody else, you know, take a shot at it. I'm not going to take this job and not be able to, you know, fulfill the values that I had. Now, fortunately, you know, the president gave me a huge runway. I think after he saw the success of the embassy move, which was really the first thing, I had a lot of credibility with him, and I had a lot less pushback from, you know, the State Department, which had always really kind of thought that I was, you know, like a summer intern coming through that would, you know, kind of come and go. When you think about the embassy move, I mean, the thing that people don't understand is that people say to me, you know, you were so smart. How did you know? Mm-hmm. How did you know that there wouldn't be any violence? You know, it wouldn't result in a war.
I remember being at the opening of the embassy and everyone said, are we going to be witnessing the start of World War III at the opening of this embassy?
Listen, certainly the left-wing media was saying this was going to lead to irreconcilable conflicts and endless wars. And had that happened, just to, you know, I mean, it didn't happen, but had it happened, you know, the president would have looked at me and would have said, what kind of a mess did he get me into? Mm-hmm. Like, what, why, remind me again why we did this? Why was this a good idea to start a war? Mm-hmm. Now, people say to me, how'd you know there wasn't going to be a war? Yeah. And on the one hand, you know, I spent a month in Washington, mm-hmm. Meetings every day with, you know, the CIA and the NSA and, you know, every other three-letter agency that you could think of, trying to figure out what would happen, trying to game this out. But at the end of the day, people were convinced. People were really convinced. You know, high-ranking people, the Secretary of State, the mm-hmm. Secretary of Defense, were convinced that, A, this was going to create violence, and, B, was unnecessary because Israel already was a strong ally. We weren't going to make them any stronger anyway. So why are we taking this risk?
Symbolic.
Yeah. Why are we doing something so symbolic when we're not mm-hmm. going to – we don't need to, and we could – and people say, how'd you know there wasn't going to be – and the answer is it was unknowable. Wow. I didn't know. Right? How do you know? How do you know no one's going to pick up a Molotov cocktail or a hand grenade and throw it into a crowded area? And all of a sudden, the New York Times has a headline saying, Trump, impulsively, puts the world at risk by, this symbolic gesture, right? And people would potentially, it would be a good argument. Look, you do something like this and it starts a war. You can make an argument that it wasn't a good idea. So people say, how do you know? So, the bottom line is I didn't know. Nobody knows. But can I tell you, give you a little biblical story about how I know?
Please.
Okay. So if you look at the second chapter of the book of Isaiah, right? So he has actually the paradigm. He creates the paradigm for peace because he... The words are well known in English. A nation will not lift up sword against nation or study war anymore. It's such a paradigm that's carved into the walls of the United Nations, right across the street on 48th Street and First Avenue, called the Isaiah Wall. Okay, well, the Isaiah Wall doesn't include the prior two verses, which they should have included because it tells you how to get there, right? I mean, it's great to say we'll have peace. How do we get there? So Isaiah says is that, there will come a point when the nations of the world will come to the mountain of God, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And they will go there. Why? Because of the famous words that the Jewish people say almost every day in prayers, out of Zion will go forth the Torah, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And then when all these nations get to Jerusalem, what happens? So Isaiah predicts that God will resolve their differences. Mm-hmm. He will solve all their problems, resolve their conflicts, and then nation will not lift up sword against nation or study war anymore. Now, how does a nation come to Jerusalem, right? I mean, you can't lift up. Nations can have 50, 100 million people. How do they come to Jerusalem? Wow. Well, the only way a nation establishes its presence someplace else is by putting its embassy there. So,
Rabbi Ambassador Friedman.
Let me put the final point on this. In 2018, CNN, NBC, MSNBC, BBC, everybody was saying that moving the embassy to Jerusalem would result in endless, irreconcilable conflicts. 2,700 years ago, Isaiah said, you move the embassy to Jerusalem and we'll have peace. We'll start a process of peace. And who was right?
Wow.
Right? Isaiah was right because we know he's right because afterwards we then led to the Abraham Accords, right? It didn't lead to war. It led to the Abraham Accords, which were deals between Israel and four Arab nations without Israel giving up one inch of sovereignty over its biblical homeland. So, Isaiah may have, offered these words a long time ago, but these words have enduring value and they were proven right.
Okay, I'm speechless for so many reasons. I'm speechless because to have someone with such strong faith in a position of power is always a risk. Mm-hmm. And what I hear in your words is that if you walk with humbleness like Moses and the faith in our prophets like Isaiah and the belief in God, how many of us try to discern the biblical words to fit what we want to see, what's easy for us to digest, rather than looking at the biblical words and saying, everything else might be saying something else, but I believe in these ancient scriptures. And I imagine you sitting there at the CIA and all the different three-letter departments that are telling you about, the pending apocalypse because of your decision, that your name is on the line, your position is on the line, your prestige is on the line, your respect from the President of the United States is on the line. And instead of going with the knowledge and brilliance and suggestions of the highest level people in the United States of America, you turn to the words of Isaiah, and then they came to fruition. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful concept, especially now for both Israel and America is facing, that when you believe, God comes to bless it. When you try to hide from God and God says, where are you? And you answer, am I my brother's keeper? Then God goes and with what you are bringing on yourself. And when you stand up to say, I believe this is the right thing, I will take the personal risks in order to bring the right thing to fruition, you end up like Moses. And Ambassador Friedman, you were nominated in 2020 as a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, which if I was the judge, would have given to you in a second.
I have no doubt.
This was for everything that you accomplished in the Abraham Accords that you just described. Can you tell us what it was like to be standing on the forefront of history? You have grandkids who live in Israel, you have grandkids in America, mm-hmm. of being put in the position to be able to make the impossible a reality.
So, people have asked me that before, and it kind of reveals a personality trait of mine that, you know, is probably not, it's probably, you know, something I should work on more, but, I never take a victory lap ever. I don't have it in me. I was in my office in Herzliya with friends and family watching President Trump make the announcement from Washington that he was going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I was sitting at a computer typing until the last minute. I was working with the staff there to edit his final words. And then I'm watching it on TV as he makes the announcement. And afterwards, you know, people are singing, they're crying, whatever. And I'm like, just, what do I do next? Okay, what do I have to do now? I don't have it in me to rest on laurels. And I do believe that because of the magnitude of these events, that I really kind of view myself more as a messenger or a vessel or a vehicle to get these things done. And so I just keep plugging away. And I don't have that capacity to really say, oh my God, look at me. My name is carved into the walls of the embassy, which it is. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I got a street named after me in my hometown in Woodmere, New York. It's cool. My kids like it. And I'm very happy that, hope it's not soon, but when I leave this earth, my family will have, you know, a legacy that they'll be proud of. But short of that, there's still more things to do. We have just a lot more to do. And Israel right now, especially needs our help. They're going through a national trauma that, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but, you know, there's just more to do. And you just can't, if you're serious about really helping, you know, if you're really serious about your values and about trying to achieve them, there's no time to rest on laurels. You just got to keep moving ahead, because otherwise you could lose yourself in your own ego.
Yes. Wise words. On September 3rd, you have a new book coming out, One Jewish State. I want to hear more about this because I know that it's a book with all of your ideas for how we can pave peace for the Middle East, for America, something that will be good to bridge the Arab world, the entire world, and America. Was this written in response to October 7th? How did you decide that you need to write this book with a very provocative title, which we'll get to, One Jewish State?
Well, I decided to write it after October 7th, but not because of what happened on October 7th, but what happened in the aftermath of October 7th, mm-hmm. where, you know, after this, you know, unspeakable assault on the Jewish people, the worst since the Holocaust, that was then supported in numerous polls by like more than 80% of Palestinians living in Judea and Samaria. My government, or the American government, decided that the best solution for this would be a two-state solution, would be to take the land that God gave to the Jewish people, some of the most holy, biblically significant land on the planet, and to give that to people who support what happened on October 7th and people who want nothing more than to destroy the Jewish legacy within the land of Israel. So I said, all right, you know, I can yell and scream that I don't support a two-state solution. But then if you don't have a then what?
Right.
The conversation just kind of, you just create a vacuum, and vacuums in this part of the world did not get filled well. Yeah. You know, when Israel left Lebanon, it got filled by Hezbollah. When Israel left Gaza, it got filled by Hamas. When Israel left the Sinai, ISIS started moving in. Whenever Israel creates a vacuum, you know, pulls back, bad things happen. So the question is, what's the then what? And you know, part of the point I make is, look, it's sort of my frustration saying to the world, there's more than 40 Muslim states, right? 40 Muslim states where, in most of those states, if you're not a Muslim, you really are not going to lead a very comfortable life. There are a few that are more advanced, like the Emirates and Saudis, where you have expats that live there that, you know, do okay. But 40 of them, they're Muslim states. That's the official religion is being Muslim. If you're not a Muslim, you really have no business being there.
Yeah.
There's I don't know, a good number of Christian states, a good number of Hindu states, Buddhist states. Mm-hmm. And we have the Church of England. I mean, the country that, you know, America came from has a national church. Why can't there just be one Jewish state? Just one. Mm-hmm. There's never going to be two. I promise you, we'll never ask for a second one. We just want that one Jewish state on the land, which no people has a more compelling historic claim to any piece of land anywhere in the world than the Jewish people to the land of Israel. We just want that one place. It's the size of New Jersey. Like, what is the world so obsessed with just having this one Jewish state? And that's sort of the motivation. Now, that's not an argument. Yeah. That's a frustration. Mm-hmm. But that's the frustration that got me writing the book. And then I make the argument, and I think this is what's unique about this book. It's not right wing. It's not left wing. You know, we have sort of a motto: not right, not left, just smart. Mm-hmm. You could be a person of deep faith, and that's your North Star. Yeah. And you can say, well, we like this because the Jewish people will retain every inch of their biblical homeland. You could be an atheist and say, look, I just care about, you know, the economy and national security. And this works because this will result in Israel, which is the only democracy in the Middle East and the only successfully run nation in the region, having, you know, control over a minority population, which it's proven the ability, you know, to empower, like, yeah, you know, inside the Green Line, you know, the Arab population. And I go through a whole, you know, section there about how, you know, 20%, you know, the Arabs are about 20% of the Israeli population. More than 20% of all the leading universities in Israel have Arab students. I mean, more than 20% of the students are Arabs. So Arabs have, you know, they live in Israel. They don't want to go anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, you go to, we're not far now from Baca al-Gharbiya or Umm al-Fahm, right? These are entirely Arab cities.
Right.
You go to them and say, look, guys, if you want, you know, you want to live, you know, you want to be part of Area A or Area B, we'll redraw the line. 90% would say, over my dead body, yeah, we're Israelis, we're not leaving. So Israel, and it doesn't get enough credit for it, right, how it treats its minority population.
Right.
So if you just care about, you know, the economy, you care about security, you know, it makes sense for Israel to have sovereignty over Judea and Samaria. If you just care about the Jews, it's great for the Jews. You just care about the Palestinians. If that's all you care about, I want the Palestinians to lead better lives, it's great for them as well. So the whole point of the book is that no matter how you slice it, and what Mike Pompeo says in the foreword, which I think is, you know, very prescient, he says, why should any of us be surprised that fulfilling God's will is actually the path that brings the most good to the most people?
Incredible.
And that's what this book is about. It's a long book. I mean, it's not that long. It's 240 pages, but, you know, so we tackle it from, you know, arguments about faith, arguments about the economy, about security, about, the Arab world, have a section about how important the evangelical Christian support is for this. But it ultimately, you know, what it does is you have all these different vectors and you go through them, but at the end of the day, they all lead to the same place.
Yeah.
And what I think is interesting about the time in which we're living is before October 7th, you know, there was the world of faith. There was the world of national security. There was the world of, you know, economics. There was the world of geopolitics, right? You have all these different worlds. And people within who really, you know, cared about their particular vector, you know, they had their own views. And these views tended to be, you know, not reconcilable. Now, post October 7th, you know, the world of faith, the world of economics, national security, it's all heading in the same direction. And it's all heading in this direction. And that's what this book is trying to advance.
Sounds incredible. And you can tell that you're not a career politician because you actually come up with suggested solutions.
Yeah, well, that was the great definition of Einstein's definition of insanity, right? doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. You cannot possibly expect now a different result with a two-state solution. I mean, you don't want to get me started on this, but it will not work. It never has worked, and it will not work now.
So, Ambassador Friedman, what would you say is the main obstacle for peace right now between Israel and the neighbors? Would you say it's America taking the wrong side and emboldening our enemies? Would you say it's our enemies that are just unwilling to submit and recognize that the Abraham Accords are best for them and it also helps Israel?
So I can tell you something that, you know, this will come as a surprise to you, but this is my answer. The biggest obstacle to Israel achieving its destiny is Israel. Okay, it's not that, I don't mean to be critical of any particular Israeli, but the nation of Israel has punted on this extremely important issue for 55 years. Mm-hmm. Now you got people say, look, Shiloh or Bethlehem or Bethel, they're a part of Israel forever. Okay, that's, I agree. But then, put your money where your mouth is. Act that way, right? You know, when I go to Bethel, we made a movie about this with Mike Pompeo. It's hard to get there. And, the very spot where people believe Jacob had his dream with the ladder, you would think that place would be, absolutely, pristine with tourist opportunities, with, people who you can get a tour, a lecture. Yeah. It's like in the middle of nowhere. Now, what I say to the Israeli people is this. Every fourth grader knows how to draw a map of his country. Mm-hmm. You guys can't do it. Some people say it's the Green Line. Some people say it's the Jordan River. Some people say it's the blocks, whatever those blocks mean. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's the Alon Line. Most people don't know what that is, but that's another line that was, that Yigal Alon drafted many years ago. Israel has to address this issue. And I've met with the most senior people of the Israeli government. I say, look, don't do this like with a 61 seat majority. Right. Start the process of having this discussion. It can take 10 years. Doesn't matter. It's not going away. You control the territory now, most of it anyway. But have this discussion and make people understand. Can I give you an example of what a conversation I had with a secular Israeli, which I think is really indicative of how this issue has been neglected. So, part of my life is smaller part of my life, but we make some investments in Israeli companies, or we try to. So I meet with a lot of the Israeli high-tech elite in Tel Aviv, right? Yeah. They're mostly secular, brilliant, absolutely brilliant, patriotic, great people. I mean, I'm far from criticizing them, but so we talk about business, then they want to talk about politics. And I say to them, what do you think about Judea and Samaria? Yeah. And they'll say, well, I haven't been there since the army. I don't want to rule over 2.5 million Palestinians. I said to them, well, do you believe in God? He goes, I don't know. My parents are Holocaust survivors. I got issues with God. I said, understood. So I said, let me ask you a question. What do you think about, let's pick a place. What do you think about Shiloh? What do you think about it? I said, do you know what happened there? He said, no. I said, well, let me tell you. This is after Joshua brought the Jewish people across the Jordan River. He spent 7 years someplace else, and then he got to Shiloh. And the Ark of the Covenant and the Mishkan, the mobile tabernacle, stood there for 369 years. This was the Jerusalem before there was Jerusalem. This is where Samuel was born. This is where Joshua assigned to all the different tribes their territory. This is where Hannah taught the world how to pray. He says, what do you mean taught the world how to pray? So, well, she was desperate for a child. She went into the tabernacle there and she started whispering and singing to God. Mm-hmm. And the priest had never seen her before. I thought she was drunk. That's how unusual this was. But she came up with this beautiful lyrical liturgical song. And it was really the first prayer. And I said to him, look, what do you want to do? I'm an American, not an Israeli. My kids are, but I'm not. You want to give it away or you want to keep it? I said, if you want to give it away to the Palestinians, understand you'll never see it again. Right. No matter what you write on a piece of paper, their goal is to destroy the connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. You'll never see it again. It'll be destroyed as a place to visit. So I said, so what do you want to do? And this is a completely secular guy, right? I don't think he's been to synagogue in 10 years.
Yeah.
He says, we have to keep it. Mm. I said, why? I said, you don't even think there's a God, and who wrote the Bible? He goes, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. This is who we are as a people. I don't care who wrote the Bible. I don't care if the Bible was written by some smart guy, but it's been around for 3,000 years. Yeah. It's our DNA. It's what's caused us to survive up until this point. And to give away a place that biblically significant, which proves the authenticity of the Bible and the stories of the Bible and the lessons of the Bible, we cannot give it away no matter. I'm completely secular. I will not allow it to be given away. I said, but you didn't know anything about it until we talked. He said, I know. That's the problem. This is the problem.
Yeah.
This is the core of the problem. I believe that an overwhelming majority of Israelis, if you can take them out of their, you know, their hard shells, and you can just sort of, in a non-pressure environment, you know, keep the politics out of it for the next couple of years. I mean, we don't have to deal with the politics. Just start educating the Israeli people about the importance of the biblical story and what it means to the Jewish people, to anchor us to those values and stories and lessons, I think is more important than anything. Now, will the Americans go along? Yeah, that's important. That's I tell them, that's my job. My job is to get the Americans to go along. Mm-hmm. But if I said to President Trump tomorrow, look, I'd like you to support Israeli sovereignty over Judea and Samaria, the first question he'd ask me is that what Israel wants?
Right.
And he's going to say, unless Israel wants it, I'm not going to force my will upon Israel. I wouldn't do that to them. So the long-winded answer to your question is the most important thing is for Israel to be Israel. When Israel respects itself and its national heritage and its biblical heritage, I think the world will respect Israel.
One Jewish State. We're linking it in the show notes. Go and buy it now. You are my new rabbi. You are an inspiration to everyone who knows you, everyone who's followed you, everyone who's heard you. I am so happy that my listeners get once again, because I know they've been watching you throughout your career, to hear behind the scenes just how truly brilliant, faithful, convicted in what you believe, and passionate about your mission ahead. Can you end this podcast with a vision for the future, a hope for the future?
Well, look, my hope is that all of us, wherever we're living, get back to basics. I think we've lost our way, certainly in America. I think as a nation, we've lost our way. And there are answers out there for us to see. I mean, I believe the answers are in the Bible. They are incredibly, they're the works of incredibly brilliant people, divinely inspired in some cases, in the case of Moses and the first books of the Bible, really reflecting the Word of God. These are the values that I think have the potential to keep America alive as an empire. You know, people say we're on the downslope of the American empire. It's a scary thing when you think about it.
Yeah.
Scary for our children. You know, when America doesn't lead the world, I worry about the world. Who's going to lead the world? China? I mean, that's not a world that I'm particularly optimistic about. But we got to be anchored to something enduring, something authentic, something that speaks to us and inspires us and leads us to lead a moral life. You know, you mentioned earlier about the fact that when America was formed, it was very much imperfect. And, you know, there was, you know, on the one hand, we believed in the equality of man. On the other hand, we had slavery. Well, who was fighting against slavery in the 19th century? It was the preachers. It was the pastors. It was the people of faith. They were the ones who led the fight against slavery. I mean, the social justice, all the social justice warriors, okay, that were sort of looking at and saying, what are you guys fighting for? Okay, the real social justice warriors of our time are the ones that really, you know, read the Bible and were inspired by the Bible. And if we can go back to those values, you know, like social justice is not those words don't have to be pejorative. I mean, right now they are, because people are fighting for things as if they, you know, that really are not, you know, biblical values.
Corey Ten Boom, social justice warrior.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there is a place in this world for all of us, no matter how conservative we might be, to fight for social justice, but we have to anchor it to really authentic values, and those come from the Bible. I think studying the Bible is the most important thing we can do to kind of get back on track. And I think also, you know, I would say that, you know, whatever success I had, it's not because I'm a cocky person. It's not because I'm overconfident. It's because I was anchored to a set of beliefs that guided me. And I wasn't going to get knocked off of those beliefs because they were authentic and real and come from God. If you have that, you have a deep advantage. And, people say, oh, we don't trust this leader because he's too religious. No. If you are deeply entrenched in biblical values, I'll take that guy any day to run my country. So but study the Bible, read the Bible. It could be in any language that you're comfortable with, but read it and understand it and read the commentaries on it. It's the best path for a good, moral, successful life.
Ambassador David Friedman, I will end with the words that you just said. I will take that guy any day to run my country. One Jewish State, go out and buy it. You can see even more of the brilliance, wisdom, passion, and practical plans for how Ambassador David Friedman could see the reality of peace to the Middle East coming to fruition. Thank you, Ambassador Friedman.
Thanks, Yael. So good to be with you.